Okay. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Let me get this in the right place so it's not wires dragging everywhere. Okay. Welcome to the Free Association warm-up show for Saturday, the 15th of October, 2022. And I don't know how much I'm going to end up using, but I'm just going to talk, see what comes out of my mouth, and then turn it into a monologue, basically, for the next time I do it. None of this is really formal. It's just me talking to see what's on my mind. And then when it comes to doing a live show, then I know what's on my mind because I've already spoken it. That's kind of the theory of it. Plus it warms my voice up as well. So it warms my throat up, warms my voice up. And this is just practice, really. Practice and a bit of fun on a Saturday afternoon. It's about 1:30, I think. Thereabouts, just coming up to 1:30. So I was just at the monument, and there's a demonstration going on at the monument, which looks like an anti-5G, anti-vaccine, and various other issues. Mostly the 5G seems to be prominent. And the vaccine injuries are prominent as well. I know a few people who were up there. I didn't realize it was just going to be 5G and vaccine injuries. I thought it was a cost of living demonstration, but it's clearly not. It's clearly a freedom demonstration and a keep an eye on these things demonstration, just to raise people's awareness a little bit. And it could be that it turns into a monthly thing as an alternative to the bridge and St. James's Boulevard, which is what we do on a Friday afternoon. So once a month at the monument would be a good thing as well. I think so that if you can't make the bridge or St. James's Boulevard, at least as a Saturday afternoon alternative. And I think it's a good idea. I can't get to them, unfortunately, because I'm prepping the show. Well, in my head, I'm prepping the show. Usually, I just end up going for a cup of coffee and sitting thinking about it for a while, which is prepping, ultimately. So I had a conversation with Martin, conversation with Lee, both of whom I know from Stand in the Park. Martin I've known for years from philosophy groups. And there was a few other people there that I know, Carl and his dad, were both there. And it's one of those things where you start to get to know people because you bump into them over and over again at different places. And I know some people have got some dodgy views in these groups, but they are who they are. I can't change anybody else's views. I can only change my own. So what else am I going to talk about? I'm probably going to talk about Karen Kingston because that's something that's on my mind. And it's something that I do want to talk about because I'm not sure about it. I'm not sure about it, about whether to publish it or whether to engage with it or whether to just let it be. I think I probably will publish some of it. I don't know whether I'll publish it all. I don't like Stu Peters. That's the thing. I really don't like Stu Peters, and she shows up on the Stu Peters show. But there's an interview with Mike Adams, which I think I might be able to use on the radio show this afternoon if I've got time, or I could start with Mike Adams and Karen Kingston, and then move on to the politics, and then onto the geopolitics. I don't know. I don't know how exactly I'll do it. It could end up being a totally different show by the time it actually happens anyway. But this is how I'm thinking at the moment, is some UK politics, some geopolitics, and some issues around bioweapons and nanoparticles, or nanolipid structures, which are apparently intelligent enough to adapt to the environment. I don't know. I don't know how that works. My brain has difficulty comprehending it, but she's got patents, so she's got something to start with. So she's a little bit credible. She might not be 100% credible. There might be some gaps in the logic somewhere. And I'm not the most logical guy in the world, so I'm not necessarily the guy to criticize a logic, but I can take a look at it. And if I see some gaping holes, then everybody else will see the same gaping holes, and that's the part she's got to sort out, if there are any. I don't know whether there are or not at the moment. I'm just investigating, but she's talks about James Giordano quite a lot. She's deliberately mentioning the name, and he's a neurological ethics consultant for the military, which sounds dodgy to start with, but I'm going to look him up as well. So that might become part of the show this afternoon, is looking up James Giordano and just reading some of his website. I'll maybe start with Don, because the context is Karen Kingston, so I've got to put a little bit of Karen Kingston in there, because that is the context. So I'll see if there's any of that Mike Adams interview that I can use. I've got time to watch it all again. I think I'm only about halfway through it. And I got involved in some material that's on BitChute from 1985 last night, which was interesting as well, which was a colonel in the army talking about zero-point energy and scalar waves and gravitational waves and anti-gravity technology. And that's in 1985. So what the hell have they got now? What the hell have they got now? That obviously we don't know about, but it's published in patent somewhere. So it's the patent people that are finding this stuff. It's David Martin and it's Karen Kingston that are finding the material and that are able to back up what they're saying. So those are the people that I'm paying more attention to than anyone else. Now, the other thing I said to Lee when I was talking to Lee this afternoon is that I don't think the dangers of 5G are going to break for at least a year. I think the vaccine injury stuff will break first. And then it'll take at least a year. If there are serious associations and activations coming from 5G, then obviously that's going to take a lot longer to get through to public perception. It may be there, it may not, I don't know. The possibility exists that all of this is just planted disinformation. I don't know. One way or the other. But Karen Kingston says very definitely that Robert Malone was lying about certain things last year. And she thinks that he's spreading disinformation, and he's involved in a big group of people. So he could be leading people astray. And she clearly doesn't like him. So I don't know. There's some internal personal politics going on with this as well, probably. But if she's got patents, then the patents have got to be looked at. There's no doubt about that. If you can start from patents, that means there's a conversation taking place within the military about what's on the patents. James Giordano must have some public stuff on record somewhere. He must have written articles or given speeches or whatever that are on public record. So that should be easy enough to find. So that's my next task, is the James Giordano stuff. I'm going to do that now, in fact. I'm going to do that now. Give me a few minutes to set this up. Okay, there's a couple of things coming up when I do a search for James Giordano straight away. And that's neurotechnology premises, potential and problems, and neurotechnology direct and direct brain communication. So I don't know, that one's a sponsored link, so that may not be relevant. The fact that a book called Neurotechnology and Direct Brain Communication exists is a bit of a concern. But, right, so that one doesn't have anything to do with James Giordano, so let's dispense with that. So neurotechnology, premises, potential and problems. So £134.29 on eBay. And edited by James Giordano, one of two people, I think, or just him. Just him on this one. So, that doesn't really tell me who he is. It just tells me he's edited a book. But that's a start. So, scientific and philosophical perspectives in neuroethics. Right, £39. So that's a bit closer to my price range. I'm still not going to buy it though. So let's have a quick look. Scientific and Philosophical Perspectives in Neuroethics by James Giordano. So edited by James Giordano is what it actually is. Let's watch it. Right, let's not worry about it too much. I'll keep an eye on it. So, I wonder if it's on Amazon as well. Let's have a look at Amazon. James Giordano. Neurotechnology in national security and defense, practical considerations, neuroethical concerns, advances in neurotechnology. September 2014. So it's advances in neurotechnology, I think, that he's the editor of, amongst other things. But nothing on him personally comes up. Bing doesn't bring anything really useful up. If I'm going to go down the military technology rabbit hole, then I need to know where my limits are, really, because I'm not in any way an expert at this stuff. So let's just look up neuroethics. Neuroethics Brain Initiative. So, this is the NIH. It's braininitiative.nih.gov. Let's see what this YouTube video is about and how long it is. Right, it's 5 minutes, so...
Neuroethics research can help us understand the social consequences and many of the societal implications of ongoing neuroscience research. Neuroethics can help improve research design. When we think about ethical questions, as we're initially conceptualizing research, we can usually do a better job of anticipating challenges that might come up later on in research.
We think about all of the different ways in which our brain function is so central to our identities and who we are, and that informs our thinking about how, you know, as our understanding of brain function advances, and ultimately as our ability to manipulate, change, and extend brain function advances, that we're going to need contributions from all of these different domains to help us think together about, you know, what's the most responsible way to proceed with advances in science and advances in technology.
Neuroethics has really influenced our work, primarily because we work with human patients, and a lot of our work takes place in the context of patients that volunteer to be part of research studies while they are undergoing procedures for their medical care. So we found that over the years it's really been important to address neuroethics as we think about consenting processes for patients as they participate in these studies, many of whom are in really vulnerable situations. But at the same time, in many cases, would like to also volunteer and participate in research. So for us, neuroethics is about just trying to safeguard subjects that participate in the research, as well as think about the bigger picture of how the research is applied.
Think deeply about how exactly will this technology be used? What are the anticipated use cases? One of the challenges of doing ethics research is that you don't want to wait until the researchers have the question and are faced in the moment with what to do. You want to anticipate those things. You can't do that unless you collaborate with the scientific community, the ethical community, and really think about, all right, how are we going to use this technology in the real world to cure disease? And I think ethics fosters more creativity on the research side, and ultimately this is to the benefit of cures and better understanding of neurobiology.
Neuroethics plays a huge role in moving findings from basic neuroscience and translating them into clinical practice. My project, funded through BRAIN, is looking at whether it's ethical to use MRI to predict autism spectrum disorder in infants who are high risk. We're able to bring not only conceptual background, experience from other areas of research like genomics, for example, where they've been doing this for a while, but also empirical expertise to actually collect data, interview with the families, to help provide the researchers with guidance.
My BRAIN initiative research is focused on deep brain stimulation for obsessive compulsive disorder. What we're trying to do is develop next generation therapies that involve more than one electrode per side, per hemisphere, but also instead of just stimulating, we're also recording data from the brain and using that to inform treatment. From the lens of neuroethicists, having them involved on the front end so that we can collect data that tells us about the patient experience, you know, that's more granular than a clinical scale can tell us. So the earlier you can get them involved to help implement those things in your design, and then sort of walk through the entire research endeavor with them, is extremely valuable.
My BRAIN funded research is on building a portable head-only MRI scanner that will be highly mobile so that it can reach populations, underserved populations, where we can study individuals that we haven't been able to study well using functional magnetic resonance imaging, which has been mainly at big medical centers like this. People kind of consider themselves, their brain as who they are, and what we get from their brain can be used to identify them and to find certain features about them that they may not want to have publicly.
We recently won a BRAIN Initiative grant in neuroethics for looking at BCI, brain-computer interfaces, and human agency. You might be able to reorient the direction of some of the devices that are under construction, for instance, by getting input from neuroethicists, and through the neuroethicists, maybe input from some of the targeted populations for these devices. So for instance, disabled people about what they prefer, how they think about the devices, what they would want in a device, what would allow you to be willing to adopt this kind of device.
Okay, so that's the official version. The unofficial version may be something else. There may be several interpretations available. And therapy is influence, ultimately. Therapy and influence could be neurology-based a weapon. So anything that's influential can be used as a weapon, ultimately, can be used against somebody or on their behalf or against them. And the technology is neutral. It's how it's being used that's the important thing. So let's have a look for James Giordano on YouTube and see if there's anything that's actually him. James Giordano, there's actually a few different things. So, neuroweapons, DARPA, LinkedIn, CIBC, Truist. All right, so let's have a look at neuroweapons and see what comes up. From Bench to Battlefield, the realities and risks of neuroweapons. Here we go, that's an hour. I might be able to. Oh my lord, there's a fair bit of considering this is not really something that I would take notice of normally. There's a fair bit of stuff from, like, this is 8 years ago, 5 years ago, 2 years ago. So this one's from 5 years ago, from Bench to Battlefield.
James Giordano here today from Georgetown University. He is a professor. I have to read this because it's a lot. He's a professor in the development of neurobiology and biochemistry. He's a chief of neuroethics studies program and the co-director of the O'Neill Pellegrino Program in Brain Science and the Global Health Law and Policy at Georgetown University. He served on the joint staff of the Pentagon area. He heads up the EU Human Brain Project. He's going to talk a little bit about that today. He's tasked with his work is dedicated to studying and defining of current and political dual-use capabilities in neuroscience and neurotechnology. It's an extremely in-depth discussion. I encourage you guys to ask questions at the end. His area is his expertise is in brain science and can be developed and engaged in military applications, warfare applications, bioweapons, both by state and non-state actors. So I'm going to head it over to Jim.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's my second or third time being at Livermore. I've been working for a while with Zach, and it's been a real pleasure. Of course, my ongoing work with Paris and company. As Paris mentioned, one of the things that I do is I do brain science. I've worked in the area of translational brain science, which is bringing brain science from the research bench to the bedside for about the past 32 years. So I've been doing this for a while. Brain science, as you may know, has also had a fairly rapid development and trajectory of its capabilities, moving from fairly simple approaches to studying the brain to far more complicated approaches that I'll talk to you about today. But like with so many other areas of science and technology, the capability that is conferred by the science, that is the knowledge, and its techniques and its technology, therefore its tools, giving us implements, to affect in some way a biological system, renders it relatively powerful to do a whole host of things. Now, as Paris mentioned, of course, I also work as the chief of an ethics center at Georgetown. I'm working with the Pellegrino Center for Clinical Bioethics. And what I do is an area called neuroethics, a relatively new field, but not per se. The idea is that the title of neuroethics has only been around since about 2002 in informal use. But the idea of understanding the ethics, legal, social issues, regulatory issues that arise in many science and technology are quite old. What makes neuroethics a bit more interesting and perhaps unique is that the thing that we use as the focus of our study, the brain, and those techniques and technologies that go into studying the brain and in some ways affecting the brain, remain relatively unknown to us. I don't care how you twist this. There's really none of us in this room, and I've been a brain scientist for over three decades, who could tell you how the great stuff, cognition, emotion, and even behavior arise in and from that gray stuff of those squirting, squinting cells that exist in your head. We don't know that. But we're going to be Aristotelian for a moment and sort of wax philosophically. What I could tell, I enjoyed it. That's good. So I was with the philosopher in the car who gets the Aristotelian gig. The issue is very simple. We don't understand what's called the efficient cause of what the brain does. We know how it works as a basic biological system. We might even speculate, and very realistically, why it's important to a biological system. But do we know how the brain makes, quote, mind? No, we don't. Yet, that doesn't stop us, because there's something called the mechanistic paradox, which is although we need to understand the mechanism of how and why something works, we also fall victim to the fact that very often we use what's called satisficing information. In other words, good enough for government work, and we'll just proceed on smartly. Moreover, what that also does is raises the intersection of a host of unknowns. If we don't have the thing that we're affecting works, well, the beauty of it is the tools that we develop help us to understand that. But then we have to revise what we think are the key issues that come from our tool use on that thing. This is not what's called reductio ad absurdum. This is not reductive thinking. It's real. That said, let me take a little trip in time to the brain sciences, what they really do. Let me move this down here, because I'm so sure you can't see me over the bottle of water. So This slide, I think, very nicely demonstrates to you a relative 100-year history of the brain sciences, going back to an anatomical diagram that was pioneered right after the advent of anesthesia in the middle of the 1800s to be able to allow direct access to the living brain neurosurgically. Now, what that allowed us to do is to manipulate the structure of the brain, and as a consequence of that, see what artifacts occurred with regard to individuals' thought, emotionality, and behaviors. Of course, we all know the prototypic example being Phineas Gage, the railroad worker who got a tamping iron through his frontal lobes, and as a consequence of that, survived, but as the adage says, Phineas was Phineas no more. So the issue here is that there's something ticking away within your cranium that makes you, you. That renders the brain sciences exceedingly important, not anymore perhaps in certain ways as other areas of the biomedical sciences, but in ways that are both practical and philosophical. In other words, if I'm able to in some way assess and defect this thing that is in at least some way demonstrably and perhaps to a large extent responsible for making you you, your persona, your thoughts, your hopes, your dreams, well, look at the power that that can yield. We like to talk about influencing hearts and minds, but this is a question of influencing brains to influence hearts to then influence minds. Continue to look at the slide, because what you see is the interesting dance that essentially technology has allowed the brain sciences to advance. We've gone from these rather rudimentary examples of utilizing these techniques of surgery during the beginning of the last century, the 1900s, to being able to utilize ever more sophisticated anatomical and molecular probes to understand the brain at a variety of more nuanced and granular levels, and ultimately to not even have to intervene with the actual structure of the brain, but to be able to assess the brain in real time, utilizing convergent forms of neuroimaging coupled to a host of neuroelectrophysiological techniques. It's been very, very important. Because what this allows us to do is essentially something akin to this, both literally and metaphorically, which is to essentially put the brain at our fingertips. This is my brain. I take it out nightly and floss it with my haircut. It makes it rather easy. But there is something I want you to also understand about this. If you were to do exactly as I'm doing here in this slide, if you could put your brain in front of it, first of all, the mere size of it, I think, is somewhat interesting to people. We tend to think it's a lot larger. It's not. It fits in the palm of your hand. But now let's wax a little more philosophical, but very practical with that same analogy. If this is something that fits in the palm of your hand, every hope, every dream, every thought, every aspiration, everything you love, everything you hate, fits in that organ. And if I really want to wax philosophical, everything that humanity has ever done and will be is a consequence of that organ's function. Once again, we're talking about power. But let me tell you a little neuroanatomical and neuroscientific adage. We have a saying in the brain sciences, see one brain, see one brain. Which means that despite the fact that if I pulled my brain out of my head, his brain out of her, his, and her brain out of hers, it basically looked like that with regard to its gross architecture. The devils and deities lie in the details. Our brains develop as a consequence of their embodiment in me and you, and as a consequence of the environments we work in. Which means that what the brain sciences are helping to do is to figure out both what brains have in common and what brains have in difference. The beauty of that is, through the iterative use of big data, what we're able to do is to create large-scale patterns, maps, atlases of not only individual brains, but groups of brains, and use these things comparatively and normatively. The more we know, the bolder we go. Puts the brain at our fingertips. But what you want to see is that the brain sciences have, in fact, created a tremendous amount of momentum and potential. And that is the momentum to be able to assess, access, and affect. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. What it really does is it creates an opportunity to affect the way humans think, feel, and behave on a variety of levels. And those levels don't only extend within the individual organism. In other words, being able to affect thought, emotion, behavior with regard to range all the way from the synaptic to our social interactions individually. But it also allows us to then exert certain levels of intellectual assessment, knowledge acquisition, and control about human relations on the individual, to cohort, to group, to community, to local, regional, and global scale. And obviously, we can in fact use that information and arguably the capacity to be able to not just use the information, but to actually physically affect the brain through these techniques and tools in ways that are important to, meaningful for, and highly leverageable within national security, intelligence, and defense agenda. This is no different than other forms of science and technology. Arguably, one could say that the individual with the most sophisticated science and technology has always looked to bring those into those agendas to defend kin and kith, to be able to advance an ideology, to be able to defend those things we hold dear. History teaches us that. Latest and greatest tools are very often incorporated into these large-scale agendas, particularly by mechanized and technological countries. We've seen this historically throughout the ages, this being no different. So the idea that we're able to say is that the leverageability of the brain sciences extends from the synaptic to the social, from the individual to the global, is not just a lot of fancy rhetoric. It is, in fact, real and realizable. Moreover, in utilizing the brain sciences in these ways, I think it becomes important to understand a formal definition of the term that I will use repeatedly throughout this lecture. This term, a weapon. As directly cited from the Oxford English Dictionary, there are two interactive and I think important definitions of a weapon you need to understand. The first is as a means of contending against another. We hear this colloquially. You know, someone has a great sense of humor, so, oh, their sense of humor is a real weapon. In other words, they can use it well to interact with others positively and in some cases derisively. The old sort of film noir movies where it shows a sultry woman sitting in the blonde in the bar and she shows some leg and like, those gams are a weapon. Those kind of things. Yeah, it's a means of contending against another. For those of you who are far younger than I, gams is a slang for legs. It doesn't necessarily have to be in a derogative or denigrative way. It is a way of contending against another. I can use humor as a weapon to disarm someone. I can use affability as a weapon to make what may have been a potential foe or hostile, my friend. But I think the way that we use the word weapon more colloquially is the one that comes to mind and should not be ignored in this context, which is this, something that can be used to injure, defeat, and or destroy another, a potential enemy. Putting both together, we have this wonderful 25-buck definition, and I usually impugn anyone who reads a PowerPoint slide, but I just want to reinforce the definition. Somebody mitigates aggression and fosters thoughts and feelings of affiliation or passivity. Oh, in other words, if I make my enemy my friend, not my enemy any longer, that's still weaponizable, and or something that incurs burdens of morbidity and or mortality. The idea of this is something not only used to influence and deter, but actually to, in some way, mitigate or prevent an individual from exercising those actions towards me and mine. If we look at weapons, and we were to trace these historically, I think Ruddington provides a very, very good overview of the history of weapons. There are a number of different books that could provide this for you. Everything from somebody picking up a rock and using it a la 2001 A Space Odyssey, all the way up to the contemporary use of very, very sophisticated forms of S&T. What we see is as the momentum of S&T increases, the weaponizability of that science and technology in a variety of realms also increases. It used to be that I need to be exceedingly close to someone to now influence them with a weapon, and now what we see is we create both distal potential as well as much more capable potential to affect them in a variety of different ways, ranging from the sublime all the way up to the severe. So we know this to exist. There are two types of weapons, those that are called soft weapons and those that are called hard weapons. If we now take a look at the brain sciences as weaponizable, a real word, by the way, we can see that, in fact, the brain sciences are weaponizable across both dimensions, soft weaponizability and hard weaponizability. In the former sense, we're seeing that the neurosciences can be used to gain economic leverage, not least of which is because neuroscience and technology commands and captures $175 billion annual market space. There's a tremendous amount of the global economic leverage that can indeed be occurred and affected, but can also be used for somewhat softer applications in the national security space, inclusive of intelligence purposes and the use of neurocognitive sciences to develop insights to and techniques for psychological operations and information systems, what is referred to in military parlance as PSYOPs and MISO. If we now transition that into more hard forms of weaponized ability, these are the areas where we're actually looking to exert physical, not just cognitive influence and or deterrence. These are your more classical forms of weaponization where you actually see things like guns, bullets, bombs, etc. But now, when confined to biological space, we see chemicals such as drugs and other chemical agents, biological such as the use of various microbes with bacteria and viruses and toxins, and increasingly devices, which up until quite recently were not even considered to be in weaponizable space, and only very recently, with regard to the last review conference of the International Biological Toxins and Weapons Convention last December, did the Australia group raise the possibility that certain devices, namely neurotechnology and hybrid cyborg-type devices, which we'll talk about, should be considered within the larger scale of what might be a potential biological. So what we're seeing is we need to cast a broader net as we increase broader and more sophisticated capabilities. Still with me? Okay. In fact, what we're doing here is just this. We're targeting the brain. And we're targeting the brain at a variety of levels. Now, like any good target, what I have to be able to do is I need to put the pipper on point. In other words, I need to put this gun sight, so to speak, where I want it to be. Otherwise, what I'm doing is just hosing a target indiscriminately. That's not what I look to do. I don't want buckshot. I want sharpshot. So the first thing that I need to do, as anyone will tell you, is I have to recon my target area quite well so as to be able to acquire viable targets and also to avoid collateral damage. The assessment neurotechnologies do a very good job of doing that with increasing sophistication. They're not used individually. They're used in a way that's called co-registered. I can use forms of neuroimaging, and these are diverse. They run the gamut from the older forms, such as things like computerized tomography and single-photon emission tomography, to the much newer forms that utilize a highly specific electromagnetic pulse signal, not only to be able to image certain brain areas, but also to image tracts, communicating networks and nodes within the brain in a directional way in rather rapid time. I can utilize more physiological recordings, such as electroencephalography, and I've dialed in the specificity of that as well through the use of quantitative techniques. I could also look at neurogenomics and neurogenetics, taking a look at genetic profiles of individuals and groups to be able to determine what genes may be in fact coding for certain structures and functions of the brain. I can utilize proteomics and other forms of biomarkers, and I can utilize neurocyber informatics. In other words, I can harness all of these forms of assessments to a big data approach that allow me to make both comparatives and normative indices, not only within an individual, but between individuals, not only between individuals, but within and between groups on a variety of scales. So the idea of assessment technology, in many ways, combines each and all of these, and the combinatory power of that is facilitated and fortified through the use of big data. We've written comprehensively about the use of big data as a force multiplier in neuroscience and neuroweaponology, and if you're interested, I'd be happy to provide that to you. But the idea here is like so many other forms of recon, evaluation, and assessment, we as humans tend not to turn rocks over just to look what's underside. We turn rocks over so we can use what's under there. The brain is no different. If what I'm doing is I'm trying to put a pipper on target and make sure it's square on point, I want to do something with that. This is not just a let's go see mission. This is a let's go see so that ultimately we can translate this into some viable effect, either of the knowledge or to actually target these things to the use of some technique or technology. Now,
all right, I'm gonna cut James Giordano off at that point because I'm gonna use this in the actual show. I think at least the first 15, 17 minutes of it. I might be able to use half an hour of that with no issues on it at all, which means I can do 15 minutes of British politics, then the neuroscience, then the big picture stuff, maybe, and balance it that way. So it's giving some insight, and I still want to use Karen Kingston's material as well, and I don't know how to fit that in yet. I've got 2 hours, though, and I've got an hour and a half, really, before I need to make a decision. If I do it live and it turns out to be something completely different, then there's nothing I can do about that either. It just is what it is, ultimately. I'm trying to have fun with it and do research at the same time without going into a depression and completely blackpilling myself. So that's pretty much it for now. I think I've achieved what I wanted to achieve.